Welcome back to Hair Metal Memories. We are your hosts. I'm Brian.
And I'm Aaron.
And we're at hairmetalmemoriesiowa@gmail.com, or you can message us on our Facebook page. We love it when people reach out to us. This time, one of our listeners, Caleb Morris from Texas, wrote in, and he ended up sending us some really cool, like, signature Lillian Axe guitar picks from the band.
Yeah, thanks for that. That's freaking awesome.
And so a big shout out to Caleb there. Thank you for that. Yeah, if you guys have anything you want to send us, that's cool. We'll send you stickers, too. We have stickers to send you. They look great on guitar cases and stuff. Yeah. Hit us up. And he asked a question. He asked us, like, what instruments Aaron and I play, because I think he's a little bit of a gearhead. So we thought we'd talk about that a little bit here.
Oh, yeah. And that's where, you know, I don't have nearly the gear knowledge a lot of other people do. But
yeah, but you got some good stuff.
I got a bunch of stuff. But yeah, I play a Fender jazz bass. Mm-hmm. Because it's rad.
Yeah.
And most of the time I run into an Ampeg port, a flex amp with an Ampeg cabinet. But sometimes I like to get really lazy and see how tiny of an amp I can use and get away with it.
Yeah.
You know. And then an assorted grab bag of effects pedals that changes all the time.
Yeah.
But there's always a Big Muff in the chain. There's always a TC Electronic Spectre Comp in the chain. Yeah. There's pretty much always a flange and a TC Electronics chorus pedal, but those are the mainstays.
I just got a new guitar, so
it's purdy.
Yeah, and it's a real purdy one. I had a Parker Fly for like 20 years. I was playing that, and it was my soulmate guitar. And then I finally kind of got to the point of where all my friends with guitars have like 6 guitars. Why am I so monogamous to my guitar?
But it's so nice to play. That's why. Yeah, it just feels really nice. Yeah, that Parker does.
Yeah, and I still love it. But I ended up getting a Paul Reed Smith. And now I love that guitar. Like, I was kind of going into it, I didn't really need another guitar or even necessarily want one that much, but this guitar has been a real honey. So I like Paul Reed Smith's. I mostly play through a Vox AC15 amp. I like the chimey British kind of sounds, and it's it just sounds good clean, which means you can do anything with it. And I also have a fuck ton of pedals.
Yeah, it's an even bigger candy land. We've been going crazy when we record stuff.
I have a pretty large pedal board that has like a bunch of stuff, because I used to be in a shoegaze band, and you have to have a lot of pedals to be in a shoegaze band.
That board's just one row away from like gaining sentience. I mean,
right. Yeah. And on the board, I don't need to go through all the pedals, but I usually, when I use distortion, I use a Proco Rat. I love that for distortion, and especially for like leady stuff. It's like, gets really like, you know, those nice legato leads and stuff like that sound like really good through that thing. And then for fuzz stuff, I've got a Swollen Pickle. That's sort of like a Big Muff, like, you know, on steroids or something. It's a more adjustable Big Muff, I guess. That kind of thing. And then a bunch of delay pedals, and, you know, I've got a reverb pedal and stuff like that. But anyway, we can probably talk gear all day about that. But that's the kind of stuff we dink around with. And we've got a couple stories to tell you guys about since the last time we talked.
Oh, right. Oh, my God. I forgot we were going to talk about this.
Yeah. Yeah. We've got two stories. Well, the first story is just a pleasure story. We went and saw Bruce Dickinson.
That was excellent.
Yeah, he's on a spoken word tour right now before Iron Maiden does their tour. And so we went down and saw him at the lovely Hoyt Sherman Theater in Des Moines. And it was everything you would want out of it. He was, he's funny. He knows
how to tell a really good story.
Right, and he's got a lot of good stories. He's lived quite the life, you know. And he did this thing where in the beginning where you could write down questions to ask him. And then he after he talked for a while, he left for about 25 minutes, he said. He's like, I'm going to leave for 25 minutes, go get a drink or whatever and check out. He had like a special version of the new Iron Maiden video that he showed.
And it was a pretty neat video.
It was a pretty neat video, like tons of amazing animated CGI graphic stuff in it. It was like a heavy metal, like watching the movie Heavy Metal.
And I noticed during the question and answer section, he had a can of Trooper. And I was like, whoa. Don't get me wrong. There was a perfectly good beer selection at this thing. You know, yeah. I have no complaint, but I was just like, well, I want a can of the Trooper, man.
Yeah, it seems like a missed opportunity, right? Could have been selling Troopers.
Oh, well, what do you do?
But he, so I wrote down a question and he read my question. So Bruce Dickinson, he read something that I wrote.
And which one was your question again? I know you told me when we were leaving, but now I've forgotten which one it was.
I asked him if he had injured anybody while fencing. and he said, only myself was his answer to that one. So
well played, Bruce.
I guess that was good. Yeah, so that was a good story. Our other story is you should tell it.
Okay, well.
It's the story where I'm an idiot, so.
Brian texted me all excited because he found tickets to this show, and it was going to be Jack Russell and John Karabi and Ted Poley. I'm like, oh, that's cool. And they're doing like this acoustic night. Oh, how exciting. That sounds great. He says, it's in Newton. I'm like, oh, well, that's not even very far away. For those of you who don't live in Iowa, which I guess is most of you, except for the, like the five people that we know who listen to this. High five people. Yeah, Newton's like a 45-minute drive or so.
Yeah.
Give or take a few minutes. Not bad. All right, so let's get some tickets. Cool. So the Saturday comes, and I had already told my girlfriend that I couldn't drive her and her friends to the airport that day because Brian and I had this show we had to go see.
Yep.
So we drive to Newton, and it's all timed out pretty well. We get to the address of this Newton Arts Center that we see it's posted at, and we're like, wow, there's like nobody here. What the hell? Are we looking at the wrong place or something? And
yeah, and it didn't say Performing Arts Center anywhere outside the building.
No, so we drive a few blocks this way, a few blocks that way, looking for maybe where the concentration of cars is to be like, oh, here's where everybody's parking. We get out here and just follow the people. Right. So after a little bit, we finally pull over and do some head scratching, and I pull up my phone and like Google the date and Jack Russell and all this stuff, and it tells me, oh yes, this is in Newton, but it's in Newton, North Carolina.
Yeah.
So I mean, you know, basically we didn't see the show, if that's, you know, is part of the conclusion. We did, however, find out that we were a block away from this really awesome little brewery. So we went in there and had a couple of drinks, and it was nice. And then we made the long drive back home to Ames. And
that drive of shame.
Yeah, a little bit of a drive of shame. Went back to a bar here in Ames and sat down with everybody and said, so we've had a great night of not rock and roll.
Yep. And, yeah, I was so excited to think we were going to see. It was a show of acoustic hair metal, and I thought, well, of course we need to go to that.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, but it ended up, I don't know how I got marketed to for that. I still haven't, you know, to me, it looked like it was right here in Iowa, and I just, you know, in my enthusiasm, I did not.
Usually targeted ads are much better at regional marketing.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So that's just a weird one that slipped through somehow. But that was our little adventure. So we're sorry, Jack. We're sorry, John. We're sorry, Ted. We did buy tickets to your show.
Yeah.
So maybe you got a few bucks off of us, right, but we weren't there, and we apologize.
Yeah.
Because we were very much looking forward to seeing you.
Yeah. And if anybody out there lives in North Carolina and went to that show, please contact us.
Yeah, let us know. We would love to know how it was, because boy, it sounded like fun.
Yeah, we were planning on it.
There was at least a chance I could have heard like him play Hooligan's Holiday, maybe, and you know, okay.
Anyway, today we're going to talk about the 1982 album Blackout by the Scorpions.
Yeah.
March 29th, 1982
Is this now the oldest record we've talked about on this show?
I think it is, other than some of the UFO stuff on our bonus episode.
Right. Well, you know, and that wasn't that like an album really specific, but
yeah, exactly. But I think you're right. This is the oldest one we've really done.
Cuz Lock and Key would have been pretty close, right?
Yeah. True. Yeah. True. This is their eighth studio album. It went platinum, based on the strength of the single No One Like You. I mean, which I'm assuming everybody's heard. That's just like a staple of the radio.
And the funny thing was, I don't know how much difference there is, but it's possible that, because I can't verify one of the dates, that it may not have even been the first single released off the album.
Interesting.
And that will be brought up in just a little bit.
Okay. Does this pass the hair metal smell test?
We're going to say kind of, but no.
Okay. I'm going to say yes, because I think the Scorpions overall do not necessarily. But after listening to some of the lyrics, which we'll also get to in a little bit. There's a lot of songs about girls and partying. And to me, that's sort of like that fits right into the hair metal world of.
Yeah.
Yeah, the German factor puts it off a little bit too. Like German and hair metal seems like a little bit, you know, I think of German metal as being a different breed or something like that.
Well, yeah. And hair metal seems very
British and American.
I mean, Accept isn't super far away from the Scorpions, but it still feels far away from the Scorpions.
Yeah. Yeah. So sort of a mixed bag there, I guess. But here we are. We're going to do a quick, short history lesson. We don't want to go, the Scorpions have such a huge history. I don't think we want to take all that on. So we're going to do the 10,000 foot, sort of version.
Oddly enough, they start off a lot like UFO.
They do. Very much. Yeah. They were very, it's a little incestuous even. So the Scorpions were formed in 1965, if you can believe that, by Rudolf Schenker. They changed lineup and sound a lot over time, with the period of 1978 to 1992 being the most successful period for them. Rudolf Schenker is the only consistent member of the band, but
although Klaus has been involved for a very long time.
Klaus Meine, the singer, he's been on all of their albums.
Right.
He just joined a little bit later. Rudolf Schenker's younger brother, Michael, was the original guitarist, and you should listen to our bonus episode about UFO.
Because you hear a lot more about Michael Schenker.
You hear a lot more about Michael Schenker.
Because he leaves the Scorpions after a space rock record to join a band that was getting tired of making space rock records also.
Right.
So that is a thing that happened.
Very similar histories, yeah. Yeah.
And it's really great because one little side fact I'd like to throw in is one of the early members of Scorpions is named Lothar Heimberg, and I just like to say Lothar because it makes me think of one of those games that my buddy used to play on the Sega Saturn.
That does. It sounds like a fantasy game or something. Lothar is hungry. Michael Schenker was replaced with Uli John Roth. And I mostly mention that because I think you should check him out. He's very Hendrix-y. And he jammed with Smashing Pumpkins a few times on their song Gossamer. Whenever they played a couple shows in Germany, he jammed with Smashing Pumpkins. He also wrote symphonies and sort of a leader of that classical movement on guitar, sort of an early Yngwie Malmsteen kind of guy. But after he left in 1978, Rudolf Schenker and Klaus Meine sort of took control over the group. And is it Matthias or Matthias? Matthias Jabs joined on guitar, and producer Dieter Dierks. They decided to go for a more melodic sound between them.
And Dieter has engineered or produced some of my favorite records in an entirely different genre of music that isn't even in the right podcast for it, but a whole bunch of super cool German bands of the early 70s that I kind of freaked out on really bad a few years ago. But sorry, anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, him and Connie Plank, we did all the early Krautrock stuff.
Yes, you worked with Connie Plank. I mean, how freaking cool is that?
Yeah, and Dieter Dierks also did the first handful of Nectar albums, who was one of my personal favorite bands.
Nectar's so good.
They are so good. Anyway, side notes, but they auditioned over 140 guitarists before Matthias Jabs joined. So they worked pretty hard on that. Anyway, they fast forward through their history. They released the album Love Drive with this group in 1979, and it was a major commercial breakthrough.
Right as they hired Matthias, they let him go so that Michael could come back, and then he bailed.
Yeah, Michael Schenker had just left UFO, and so he showed up with the Scorpions again. They fired Matthias for 3 weeks or something like that, and then Michael Schenker's ego went into
quit during a tour, and he talked about how he didn't want to play Uli John Roth solos.
Yep. Yep.
And so he's like, okay, I'm leaving. So then, fortunately, Matthias was really good about things. Right. He was like, sure, I'll come back.
Yep, and so he came back, yeah.
So thank you, buddy.
Yeah. Michael Schenker did end up doing some guitar work for the album Love Drive. And then that was a big hit for them. Then they put out the next one, they put out Animal Magnetism,
Album's awesome.
Yeah, which also was a big hit and had the song The Zoo on it, if you're familiar with that.
Absolutely. And if you look at that cover art, you can totally tell that it was done by Hypnosis.
Right.
Because it has that weird, really saturated color scheme they like to do so much.
Yeah, much like UFO again.
Yeah. There's some other German, there was a band called Ashra that had a whole bunch of Hypnosis artwork. And one of the common themes, if you look at all the cover art, it has this weird color saturation thing going on.
Yeah.
Where it, I don't know. I don't know how to describe it because I'm not like a photo person.
Yeah.
But look at the photography based.
Yeah.
Def Leppard's High and Dry is also by Hypnosis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if you look at the way they process colors in their photography, it's all very of a of a theme.
And tons of Pink Floyd albums and stuff.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got like a book that's about hypnosis called Walk Away Renee, and it's just like all their album covers. It's just a book of all their artwork they did for stuff. It's one of my favorite, you know.
It's up there with the Roger Dean books, man.
Right, yeah, exactly. Blackout was recorded at Via San Picar. It's French, so I'm probably mispronouncing it.
We won't tell anybody.
Yeah, it's a studio in France, and then at the Dierks studio in Cologne, West Germany. So this is back when still there was East and West Germany. Klaus Meine was experiencing throat problems during the prep work for Blackout, and he had to undergo a throat surgery. So Don Dokken, from the lead singer of Dokken, came in to create guide and backing vocals. But luckily, Klaus Meine recovered enough to sing all the material, and Don Dokken ended up just being credited as backing vocals on the album. But and I was just reading an interview with Don Dokken about that, because a lot of people thought, oh, Don, you know, he was almost the singer for the Scorpions, and he says no, not really.
No.
He said that even if they would have offered it to him, he would have turned it down because it's too hard. He said that he goes, Klaus Meine's vocals are way up there. He's like, I can't sing that high. That's like Don Dokken.
And Don Dokken can't sing that high, even as high as Don Dokken used to be able to sing.
No, he can't anymore. But like, but back in the day, he was up there. And another kind of fun thing about this album, Rudolf Schenker said in an interview in Kerrang! Magazine that he couldn't choose between his guitar solos for China White. And so there's different ones between the European and U.S. versions of
the
album.
I'm really curious about that, too. So I actually, because I have a U.S. pressing.
Okay.
I don't know exactly which one because I haven't tracked it down yet. But it's clearly like a period pressing of the original run. And I just found a cheap copy of a UK one, so I'm gonna compare it. whenever the hell it shows up.
Right. Yeah, that'd be a good A/B sort of experiment.
Yeah, I'm fun to know.
Yeah, because they like both of them so much, you'd be like,
it's not the only time I've ever bought a record because they had different guitar solos on a song. That isn't even the first time I've done that. So.
And another interesting tidbit I thought was I saw in an interview that Klaus Meine said that they mostly, someone asked him, why are all the Scorpions in English if you're from Germany? And he said they wrote it in English because when they first started out, Germany's standing in the world wasn't so great. So they didn't feel like identifying as much with Germany. And they wanted to be more of an international band anyway. And he felt like English was more of like the international language at the time.
Honestly, even a whole bunch of the bands at the same time that was then coming out of Germany did a lot of stuff in English.
Yeah.
When you dig into the world of krautrock, there's lots of English lyrics in there.
Right, that's true. We mentioned how like most of the Scorpions album covers were done by Hypnosis, you know. But for this one, it's a self-portrait by Gottfried Helnwein, who's
quite a crazy artist in his own right.
He is a crazy artist.
I was looking
artist.
Into him when we were getting ready for this, and wow, he's pretty cool.
Yeah, he did a cover for like the first big Rammstein album, and I kind of knew him because my wife and I lived in Germany for a couple of years, and his artwork's all over the place. He's pretty revered there, and so I have like a postcard book of all these different images that he did, and I was surprised at how many
fascinating.
Of them. Yeah, how many of them I recognized. It's like, you know, he's done album covers. He's done he met Andy Warhol and all, you know, and he did all these portraits. He did like covers for Rolling Stone magazine a couple times with just portraits of celebrities and things. He had a weird style. Yeah, he's a very cool artist though, and he's worth checking out. He's very celebrated over there. So, and then one other little tidbit about the band is Matthias Jabs has a music store called MJ Guitars in Munich, Germany. Like, it's still running.
Oh, that's him.
Yeah, there's a website for it and everything. I went to the website. You can buy guitars in euros off of his website. So, so that's kind of cool.
I'd buy a guitar from that guy.
Yeah. So what are your memories with Blackout? I mean, it's like a loaded question.
Right. It came out when I was two. You know, I mean, when I came of age, like, to, you know, be, like, listening to music and stuff, I knew who the Scorpions was because they got played a lot on MTV all the way through, you know, right up until grunge took over. They played lots of Scorpions on MTV. At least I saw a lot of Scorpions. But I remember, and then also, you know, I heard like Can't Live Without You and No One Like You on the radio and stuff like that. Yeah. And I didn't give a lot of their albums a whole lot of time until like my early 20s. I went and got, I think I bought Blackout at a store just because I was like, oh, I've never actually listened to a Scorpions record. I've never really been that into them. And I think that was the first one I bought. And I put it on and was like, holy shit, this album is fucking raging, man. Like, okay, this is really cool. And I kind of started to come around on my opinion. Because I just, because originally I kind of thought of them as a hair, as like a passe group that was, that came before Hair and was kind of maybe not that.
Yeah.
This, you know, all just me making this shit up in my head, apparently. But because I didn't really understand how big they were or anything like that when I was little. They were one of those bands that got played on TV with everybody else. And
yeah, they almost seemed like a caricature of themselves.
I didn't know anything.
Yeah, because they'd already made it and were huge and were already rock stars. And
yeah, and they're one of those bands that hit it big way, you know, in other places before they really hit it big here. Yeah. Sort of like, you know, the way the Small Faces were big everywhere else except for here. And
yeah.
But yeah, I started listening to this in like 2001 or 2002, I think, and have freaked out on it since then.
Yeah, and I heard I knew about the Scorpions when I heard Love at First Sting in high school because, you know, Rock You Like a Hurricane
came out.
That's like 84. Yeah. So that came out when I was in high school. I would have been like a sophomore in high school. And I loved that, of course. It was like, you know, right song at the right time and all that and seemed like badass.
See, I had a hard time getting into like Love at First Sting when I first heard them. I was just like, I don't know about this, man.
Yeah. I dug it. I bought the tape of it, I believe. And like, you know, and then the other songs, you know, the other songs off of that became hits. I had seen some of my friends that were into metal were telling me, dude, you should listen to Blackout. This is, you know, but and I liked the cover. I thought it was a cool cover, but I never really got around to it. And so I actually didn't discover this till much, much later. I went on and got like a Scorpions Greatest Hits disc at one point and listened to the songs from their background. And so I was familiar with some of their back catalog because of that. But this is a relatively new album to me, actually. So,
oh, right on.
Yeah, like all the non-hit songs were pretty new to me until just when you and I went down to a record store in Des Moines, like a couple years ago. And then
that copy of Blackout was there, and I'm like, dude, get it.
Yeah, you said you should get it, and I had always meant to get around to it, and the price was right. So, and I got home and put it on, and I thought, yeah, this will be fun. I'm going to listen to Scorpions. And instead, I was like, really just like, damn, this is a good album.
Right? Well, because like, you know, so much of the time, like the really big songs.
Right.
Don't really always sell just how freaking rockin' Scorpions were.
Right,
And it's not that the big songs aren't good, but like, you know, I mean, like Blackout, like the title track, is like rock so much harder than so many of the other like really big ones and things. And
yeah.
So it's just kind of odd when they always pick like the kind of the ballads or the, I mean, I guess it's calculated that way. The ballads are the big anthemic ones, but the hard rockers are always like that. You need to be, go get the album and get the reward of hearing the cool, like super rock deep cuts, you know?
Yeah. I can tell like the non-radio ones basically were probably big favorites at like shows for fans and stuff like that because, you know, it was them just rocking out for the fun of rocking out, you know? Yeah, let's dig into the album.
Yeah.
For me, overall, I was surprised at how many like party and girls kinds of songs were on this record. Mostly, that was my mostly this time when I was doing like a deep listen of it, you know, and thinking
about
it. Which
is funny because, you know, like party and girls is like a major Hair thing, but you don't really get the major Hair explosion for like another year or two.
Right. Yeah.
Until it really starts becoming like a big thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and I wondered if like they were influenced by like because AC/DC had like some songs like that and stuff. So I wondered if they were like trying to tap into some of that maybe or something. I don't know. But I mean, I expected all the playing on it to be great, and it is. But I hadn't really thought of them as like a party band until like I listened, and I didn't know Blackout was that kind of an album. I hadn't listened to the lyrics before until just now. So. So we start out with the song Blackout, like you were just talking about that. And it's a nice lean and mean way to start an album, man.
As
it's
my first note says, that this is how you fucking open an album.
Yeah. And a nice wailing solo. You know, let's just dig in and play some of this.
Yes!
I love this solo. So.
We'll be right back.
I love those little pinch harmonics in there. Like that's one thing I miss about modern guitar solos. Nobody throws that in there.
That's kind of a done thing unless you're in metal.
Right, yeah. You hear a little bit of, you know, some people still do like tapping and some of the other tropes, but you don't hear much of like the pinch harmonic stuff for some reason. And like,
not unless you're Zach Wilde or Machine Head.
Yeah. You know, nothing too lyrically advanced here. This is about having a blackout, probably from partying too hard. It's like, but like, it just, they're raging it and having a good time with it. The next song, Can't Live Without You. Lots of really cool little guitar fills throughout this song.
Released as a single in the UK.
Oh, okay. Nice. Okay. And it reminds me of Van Halen. Like, you know, when you hear like David Lee Roth sing and then, you know, Eddie's doing that.
You get the little sort of like punctuation guitar or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. Some of the call and response within like the verses and stuff like that. So it's really cool. Yeah. So it reminded me of Van Halen, who are not a hair metal band, right? Yeah, I feel like this is going to be an ongoing, ongoing joke for us.
But this was the song that made me convinced that like the tandem of Matthias and Schenker, at least with the context of this album, every bit as good as like the tandem of Schenker and Roth or the Schenker and Schenker. You know, it's like, these dudes are really good together.
Yeah, they are really good together. Yeah, he's no slouch. Yeah, the lyrics on this one are about the audience. That's I liked that. That was like sort of a nice giving back, you know, sort of sentiment. And this, it has another great guitar solo on it. I mean, you know, they're pretty consistent with that. And then we go to No One Like You.
And that's one of the big ones.
Yeah, and this is just a stone cold classic. You know, everyone's heard this. Ripping guitars, and it's just kind of a sexy love song, is, you know, I mean,
I called it sort of it's sort of the Rock You Like a Hurricane predecessor.
Yeah, it is. And that second guitar solo has those sweet, sweet harmony guitars in it. I mean, it's just like a touch, but it just really makes it. And I'd kind of forgotten about that. And so, like, revisiting the song, you know, because to me, I've heard it a million times and I don't like think to listen to it. But this time when I listened to it, that really stuck out. So I kind of wanted to play those. I know everybody's heard it.
There's something in the solo that I was into too.
Okay.
From a different perspective.
Oh, do you want to set it up?
No, go ahead.
Okay.
What I was really fond of in it was so many times in 80s rock, the bass line is buried further in a mix.
Oh, yeah.
And Francis Buchholz's bass is just engineered really well there. The tone of the bass during the solo, and he keeps it chill, but he throws in a few little and a couple little moves. It's just really cool underneath their solo. And I'm just, That was what I was drawn to during it.
Yeah. No, good call. I mean, because he's doing all those stops. Bump.
They just leave so much space.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is, you know, for something, you know, a type of music that's used to excess. Nice to hear.
Even in the chorus, you know, during how the song's, you know, it's this big anthemic tune. But like in the chorus, it like there's spots where it goes quiet, except for drums.
Yeah.
Drums and vocals, they leave so much space between the guitars. I just thought that was really cool.
It is really cool. Yeah. Next we have You Give Me All I Need. This one starts with acoustic guitar, which they'd really done a good job of incorporating into their sound by this point.
It's almost kind of a deception because it's like this little acoustic intro and it's like rock and roll.
Yeah. you know, it's a pretty straightforward love song. But this one's about trying to keep a relationship together, which I thought was kind of cool. Definitely a power chorus. It just repeats the same line, you know, the title of the song over and over again.
And Herman Rarebell wrote the lyrics to this one.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty cool. I mean, letting the drummer, like, you know, get some Neil Peart sort of thing there.
He has a lot of writing credits on lyric credits on this album.
Yeah, and they kind of, at the end, they just repeat that line again until it fades out. They have like a fade out over it, you know, making it that much more anthemic and all of that. Which brings us up to the end of side one now.
And this song fucking rips.
Yeah, this song rips. It's the shortest song at 2 minutes and 34 seconds. And this is a pretty short album. The whole album is only 36:42. So, like, you know, a 36-minute album. But it's one of the...
That's doing it right.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is one of the few songs, even though it's short, it's one of the few songs that has a bridge in it. They don't do much with bridges.
That's a really good point. Yeah. I didn't even think about that when I was listening to it. But yeah, you're right. It has a bridge.
Yeah, which is kind of weird for a short. You know, they use part of the 2.5 minutes to go to a bridge. So I thought that was interesting. Pretty straightforward rock band partying and playing live shows kind of a song. But the thing that really stood out to me is that Klaus Meine really, you know, we were talking earlier about Don Dokken saying, I can't sing like Klaus Meine because it's too up there. He has a shriek at the end of this that is just like way up there. And so I kind of wanted to play that. It just makes me kind of laugh whenever I hear it because it's like, damn.
Yeah, and now, okay, this song was released as the B-side of a single with When the Smoke is Going Down in the Philippines, of all places.
Oh, okay. Okay. Interesting.
If you can find a copy, good luck. They're expensive.
Yeah. So we start side two off with Dynamite. And this is another great rocking tune. But this is one where I kind of wish I hadn't paid attention to the lyrics.
Yeah, because it's a song that I think is a testament to awesome LP sequencing.
Yeah.
Like they understand like opening that side two on a rager.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Yeah. It has the lines in it. Shoot my heat into your body. Give you all my size.
Maybe it was talking about those cheese filled hot dogs.
It could be.
It could have been. You know, maybe they were hungry when they wrote that song. That maybe benefit of the doubt.
It could be a translation factor too. You know? But there's more screaming guitars throughout the song, and also more high pitched shrieking vocals at the end. So you know, and so it's like I don't know. I thought the solo
on this one was nuts too. To be honest with you.
Yeah, it is a good one. Yeah. And then the next one is the weird, this one's sort of like, I hadn't paid attention to this until today, that the title's Arizona. And it's like weird to think like, why are these German guys singing about Arizona?
There's no way it's not a tour story. Because, once again, Herman Rarebell wrote the lyrics to this one too.
Yeah. It seemed to me to be about a groupie in Arizona that he banged in a car.
Probably. Yeah.
That's what it seemed to be about. There's some very melodic, thought out guitar playing in this one too. It's like you can tell that this wasn't just, you know, they weren't just, you know, making it
up. And he gets to do the punctuatey thing in this song too, where he does a whole bunch, you know, the lyric, there'll be Klaus's lyric. And then you go, woo!
Yeah. So that's pretty cool. You know, and another fade out, you know.
It sounds nothing like the song Arizona by Scott McKenzie from the 60s. You'll be very disappointed if you go looking for one and find the other.
Excuse me. And then we have China White.
The epic.
Yeah. This is a song about the apocalypse, oddly enough. So after all of this talking about parties and girls and stuff, let's take, you know.
It's time for a hard left turn.
Yeah, it's in the vein of like War Pigs, really, where it's talking about how war is evil and all that stuff. This is the longest song on the album. It's just about 7 minutes long. And the solo on this album has a completely different tone than every other solo.
Yeah, they really mixed it up. At least for the one that we're referring to, which is the U.S. solo.
Yeah. And this is, it's very icy sounding and a little bit out there, which I kind of liked. So I wanted to play this too.
Yeah.
Let's check this out.
Yeah.
And that's and this song has a bridge too, right there. We're going into the bridge. So, yeah, those might be the only two songs on the whole album with bridges. But man, I love that guitar tone. That's like the closest that they ever got.
What a strange.
Yeah, it's a very industrial, metal sounding, and you know, that reminds me like a lot of Robert Fripp, who's one of my favorite guitar players. Like where he does that icy sound thing and playing with modes and stuff, very menacing sounding.
You know? They're usually pretty dependable. You know, that sort of just good old fashioned amp driven overdrive sound, which I like. Don't get me wrong, but
yeah, that very modal playing, that kind of Eastern music thing in it. I love that song. That's a great song. Which brings us to the last track. There's only 9 songs on this album. When the Smoke Is Going Down, you'd kind of mentioned that earlier. This is their power ballad, which I think is kind of a precursor to Still Loving You.
I thought it sounded like a very kind of a sequel to Holiday.
Okay, yeah. So there's a little bit of there's a couple threads that have line, going through through their catalog. Musically, anyway, yeah, definitely. It seems to be about the come down after a show is kind of what I was getting out of it. It's a really pretty tune, and it's a really nice closer to the album, I thought.
Absolutely. Holiday, the way it closes Love Drive, much the same capacity.
Yeah, they have a little bit of a formula.
Hey, whatever. I like AC/DC too. So,
yeah,
you know.
Same. Yeah, formulas aren't always bad.
Nah.
You know? All right. You've been talking a little bit about records. You want to talk about some records?
Oh, let's talk about some records. So yeah, the pressing history for Blackout, and boy, what a history it is. This, you know, with a lot of records, you'll see like a U.S. release, maybe one or two countries in South America, the U.K., Europe. This one is amazing in how everywhere it was. I mean, you know, you'll see a Japanese pressing, an Australian pressing, maybe something in Russia. And this one was like everywhere. Every single country seems like it has a pressing. You have the first European pressing, and there's like 3 pressings of the album in Mexico in 1982. And every country in South America, right down Ecuador, just all of them. It's Ecuador and Peru and Chile and Brazil. And like every individual company or country throughout Europe almost has like its own pressing, as opposed to just that one European pressing that goes out. Just how many individual places have their own pressing is crazy. In the U.S., one of the early CD releases, because you know it was like 1984 that you really start getting CDs, and it was one of the early ones that made it there, and it gets printed most years through the 80s, and there's a little gap through the 90s, but even in the 90s there's a few LP pressings that pop up, and then of course in the late 2010s then you start seeing all the big reissue series, you know, where everything starts coming back into print again, and they finally did a re-release of the LP in the U.S. in 2015. So there was kind of a gap there. Okay. A lot of other countries had LP repressings before that, albeit in smaller runs. But yeah, there's 191 different editions of this album.
Wow.
So there's a lot to dig into there.
Wow. That's impressive. They truly are like a global band, aren't they?
Very much so. I mean, the sort of everywhere pressing you see reserved for things like, in the world of like heavier rock anyway, like Queen or Iron Maiden, you know, like when you get like the big dog status. I mean, there's even like some of the bands we've talked about on here that don't have that, you know, like, I mean, granted, Badlands is an extreme example, but there's just a handful of pressings of their album. Even stuff like, I mean, White Lion was a platinum band, and they don't have quite the same like global presence that you know. So it's just this was everywhere.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting, and then that kind of reminded me that this isn't vinyl related, but it's talking about the idea of them being a global band. When I was living in Germany, I taught English, conversational English at the school. And I thought when I moved to Germany that I was going to find all these people that were really into krautrock and stuff like that. So I kept asking, you know, when I first moved there, I was excited, and I would talk, you know, anytime I made a friend or whatever, I'd say like, so are you really into, you know, Con and Noi and all that stuff? And nobody, a lot of them hadn't even heard of those bands and, you know, and things like that. And at one point, like, so I was in this conversational English class and I asked, cause I thought it was a good icebreaker question, you know, hey, I've been, you know, listening to this stuff. I'm a big fan of German music and all of that. Let's talk about that. And this one woman told me, she was like, I think I heard of some of those bands. Like, my dad listened to those. And I realized how uncool Krautrock was in Germany. Like how, but then she said, she goes, I'm more into modern bands like the Scorpions, you know, which strikes me as kind of funny now, but I also thought she wore Scorpions shirt to the class and she was really, and she was like, you know, she was like probably like 18 at the time, you know, and this was in the 90s or something like that. And, but it made me happy that there was like German Scorpions fans, you know, I thought that's cool, man.
Oh no, that's awesome. But yeah, no, it's funny that you go there and have trouble finding like kind of Noi fans. That's
right. Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah. But, yeah.
Oh, well, you know, what are you going to do? What happens?
Yeah.
I have that same problem here. I'm like, oh, do you like Can? They're like, no, I don't know who that is.
Right. Yeah. 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 I figured over there it was like everywhere for some reason. And that's not never proven to be the case. So, yeah.
I mean, it's sort of like when you think about it, back in their heyday, like the Misfits probably only sold 5-10,000 copies of their records. So
that's true.
You know, they're not quite as like all over the places.
That's true.
You know, and then became the way we think of them now.
Yeah, and it became hugely influential afterwards.
So
and, yeah,
yeah.
And you can still ask people about you know, hey, the Misfits, and be like, who?
Yeah.
Should we talk about some gear?
All right, let's talk about some gear.
All right. One of the things I thought was fascinating when I was doing looking up their gear is Klaus Meine has a signature guitar, which I thought was
what?
Yeah, he plays guitar in a couple songs.
I mean, cool. That's great.
But that ended up being like he did. And I think, as we're going to see, like a lot of there's guitar manufacturer in Germany called Domengett. And all of them basically have signature models. So I think that Klaus Meine probably got one just because of the association with the band and with it being a German manufacturer. But I don't know. But I thought that was a pretty cool thing. Like he has his own signature model guitar.
That is wild.
Rudolf Schenker, he's played some Strats, but he mostly plays Gibson Flying Vs. He has these Dean acoustic V models, like acoustic Dean guitars V's. In the shape of a V. In recent years, he mostly plays these Domengett guitars. He has several signature models actually with them.
In no way surprising.
Yeah, he mostly plays through Marshall amps, mostly like the JMP, the JCM 800, 2203, and the JCM 800 2205 heads. Those are the main ones he plays through. Currently he uses this is a brand of amp I hadn't heard of before, ENGL Engel. I don't know if it's either that or ENGL.
I don't know that one either,
but he is endorsing the E650 Richie Blackmore signature heads, which I thought made sense. All of the European guitar players all worship at the cult of Blackmore, I think, so that made sense.
Understandable.
Matthias Jabs plays a Kort Garage to Matthias Jabs signature model, and I remember Kort being not like all that great of a model.
I always thought, well, wasn't that like one of those like budget label like entry guitars you'd get when you were a kid or something?
Yeah, I used to have a Kort, and it wasn't a very good guitar. So
I mean, on the other hand, I guess, you know, like the members of Boris have like custom first act guitars, so whatever.
Right? Yeah, yeah, yeah. So he has his own model of those. He's played Strats. He plays Gibson Explorer 90, which are those weird body guitars. Like Cheap Trick plays them sometimes and stuff.
Well, isn't the Explorer like that's like a James Hetfield guitar?
Yep, James Hetfield plays them. Yep. And then he has several signature models of the Domengett guitars too. He plays through a Mastertone Orange 60 watt head, the Mastertone 50 head. He has a ton of stuff. He has a Boss DS1 distortion pedal, a Boss CH1 super chorus, those are very common pedals. So,
yeah.
So I thought that was kind of cool. He does that. He has a Dunlop Heil HT1 talk box, which I think he probably started using it. The Zoo has a talk box solo.
Right.
So I bet that was when he started using it. And he has a number of like switching pedals that he uses because he has a whole rack mount gear system because he's in the fucking Scorpions.
Naturally.
So he switches between these racks and things. The drummer, Herman Rarebell, he's been a longtime user of Ludwig drums and Paiste cymbals, which he used for his entire duration with the Scorpions, though he would occasionally alter the amount of drums and cymbals he would have on his setup. So he hasn't veered too much. He's kind of kept
found it. What he liked.
Yeah. The bassist, Francis Buchholz. I thought this was kind of interesting. He founded a PA and stage lighting rental company in 1978. Called Rock Sound in Germany. The company began as a way to distribute these special exponential loudspeaker cabinets that he developed. And so apparently, he's apparently into, like, you know. But he also created the company to provide employment for the Scorpions roadies when they weren't on tour, which I thought was pretty cool of him. And this company thrived in the 80s and 90s. And so an exponential horn, the thing that they're talking about that he developed, I did a little research into that because I was like, I'm curious and nerdy about this shit.
This is all new to me.
It has an acoustic loading property that allows the speaker driver to remain evenly balanced in output level over its frequency range. So that means, like, you know, as the frequencies sort of change and stuff like that, you can, like, turn it up and the volume will go up exponentially in sync. And there's a bunch of, like, problems with that kind of stuff. And, you know, I read there's a lot of issues with these kinds of speakers is the little bit that I read about them. But they're very widely in use and, like, there's a lot of advantages to them as well. But I thought it was kind of cool. Like, talk about a cool side gig.
No kidding. That's like the raddest side gig I've heard of the people we've talked about so far.
He plays Warwick Streamer LX4 basses along with vintage Fender P basses, the precision basses. And he has a gear page on his website of what he plays. And he plays an Ampeg SVT amplifier and 8x10 cabinets, which I have
an Ampeg SVT.
Thought you would relate to.
It's in my closet.
He's got a custom-built 4x12 Gauss cabinet, custom-built 2x15 Electro Voice cabinets, custom-built JBL high-range horn cabinets, Rotosound strings on his bass.
That's how you hold your group together.
Yep. Jim Dunlop nylon picks, Shure microphones, and a Pro Tools recording system. That's what he lists for his gear.
And a Pro Tools recording system.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, they don't play around.
They don't play around. No,
That's quite the setup. I do find it interesting that he has just a DS1, and the one dude has a DS1 in his chain. Yeah. Like, you probably could just, like, customize to your heart's content. But it's like, right. Oh man, that's good DS1.
Yeah, this is fine. This is what I used before.
I mean, hey, no hate.
Yeah, no, it kind of humanizes them a little bit in a way.
I still love the HM2.
Yeah. Cool. Well, any other last thoughts on Blackout?
Just that if for some reason you're listening to this and you don't have it, you should have it.
Yeah, you should have it. And if it's been a while since you played it, pull it out and play it again. It's
Hell yes.
This album rocks, man. Hope you enjoy. And thanks for listening.
Thanks, everybody.